before us today is House Bill 78, which is a carryover from the last meeting. If my recollection is correct, we adopted the committee substitute last week. And so the committee substitute is before us. Is there any further discussion on the committee substitute? Any motions on the committee substitute?
Mr. Thompson, bill with individual recommendations.
The bill has been moved with individual recommendations. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill is moved. The next bill before us today is House Bill 71 relating to a State Health Resources Authority. I think we're on teleconference, is that correct? Anchorage Online, it's a listen-only teleconference at this point. We will try to cover as much ground as we can before 1:30, where a couple members of ours have to take off. Representative Boyer, if you could join us at this point and start things off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have Senator Duncan join me.
Great. All right. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on HB 71. As you may or may not know, HB 71 is a companion bill to an currently identical bill that was introduced on the Senate side last week or the week before last, and a bill that has had some hearings in the Labor and Commerce, or I guess the Labor and Commerce Committee over on the other side as recently as yesterday. HB 71 is the outgrowth of the work over the last 2 years of the Healthcare Cost Containment Task Force, a task force that the legislature created in direct response to a $20 million shortfall in the coverage of our health insurance premiums a couple of years ago. So in kind of direct response to that, we realized that we had to take some steps and change the way we were doing business in order to kind of curb the increasing cost of health care insurance to the state. And that was our initial charge, and we went about our business and have managed to save about $20 million over the last 2 years because of efforts of the task force and actually the direct response of the employees of the state of Alaska and the insurance company, Aetna. But as a natural outgrowth of our efforts and looking at cost control kinds of things, it leads you to a whole set of other larger issues, and those larger issues are kind of where we're at today. And the chairman of the task force has been Senator Duncan. And what I'd like to do is perhaps give Senator Duncan an opportunity to describe in a little different detail what we've been doing as a task force and how we get to the bill today. And then, Mr. Chairman, perhaps I'd take a few minutes and walk through the bill so that you kind of get the highlights of what we're proposing here, and then take questions, if that's all right with the chairman.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will very briefly try to explain what the task force has been up to over the past year and what we've found to some extent. We also have with us, Mr. Chairman, the consultant to the task force. Has been working as a consultant for over 2 years now, I believe, on health care issues. And he's available to fill in the holes that we might leave, and also to answer technical questions and provide the expertise that probably neither Representative Boyer nor I have at this time. As Representative Boyer indicated, the task force was expanded from its initial charge to address the problem of access to affordable and adequate health care for all Alaskans. That includes not just the public sector, but the private sector employers and employees in this state. Throughout the last 6 months during the interim, we've held extensive hearings throughout this state on the issue. We've met with the provider communities, the doctors, and the hospital association at least two times with each body. We have talked with the insurance companies. We've met with private employers, large private employers, and also with a number of organizations that are interested in health care and have some expertise and some background in it. We found out, of course, a number of important things. One is not just an issue that faces public employers, it's an issue that's facing everyone in the state. We met with the large private employers. We had about 15 of those corporations represented. It came clear to us that they were facing the same problem that we were facing in the public sector. Healthcare costs were rising dramatically, and that something needs to be done to address it before the system collapses. The figures that we have been able to put together as a result of our work indicate that in 1979, for example, we were spending $480 million statewide. State health care expenditures was $480 million. In 1989, that had risen to $1.5 billion. The projections are that if we don't do something if we don't take long-term steps to contain that cost or control the cost, that by the year 2000, we'll be spending $10 billion in this state for health care expenditures. It's a very rapid increase, and it's going to cause problems for anyone to provide adequate health care to their employees or for a large number of people to have access to health care. We've also found that there's 90,000 people in this state. This is the best estimate we have, 90,000 people who are either uninsured or underinsured, who do not have access. Not that those folks aren't getting health care, but as they get it, when it reaches a catastrophic problem instead of preventive health care, much of that shows up as uncompensated care for the providers, for the doctors, the hospitals, the dentists, whoever else it may be. And that does have a tremendous impact on health care costs in the state. We've also estimated that if we don't do something, that uncompensated care area, the uninsured, underinsured population, will increase from the 90,000 people we have today to a quarter of our population, 25% of our population by the year 2000. So based on all of that, it seems that we do need to begin to address on a very comprehensive basis, on a long-term basis, the problem of rising health care costs in this state. And that's kind of where we're heading, or we hope we're heading, in a very comprehensive package that is before you today and we have introduced in the Senate. We've also found that there are a number of reasons why health care costs are increasing. That there's not just one sole culprit. We're not pointing fingers at one group of individuals or providers or insurance companies, but that everyone, us as consumers and everyone, contribute to the fact that the health care costs are increasing and that we need to be in this solution together, and that's what we're striving to do. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do at this time, just to give you maybe some more background, some technical information, is ask Mr. Melick to come to the table, and perhaps he could present in more specific detail what some of those factors are that are contributing to the rising cost of health care, not just in the state of Alaska, but nationwide, and how what the task force has found as far as addressing it, and there goes specifically to the legislation which Mr. Boyer, Representative Boyer, will
do for you. That'd be great. Mr. Chairman, while Jeff Malik is joining us, you know, we have to put this all into context. I mean, we have a huge budget. We'd all be interested in cutting that budget, and this is a part of our, I mean, what we're talking about here drives our budget at the state level as intensely as it does the feds. The feds this year spend $660 billion in health care in all of its various manifestations. And the state of Alaska, as Jim said, $1.5 billion in this health care economy, which the state budget is a big piece. And so it's incumbent upon all of us to kind of work together and try some innovative things. And that's what we're proposing here. They're not non-controversial, I'll say right away. But the need is very much upon us. And I mean, Jeff can highlight some of the national kind of trends.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jeff Malik with the Healthcare Cost Containment Task Force. As has been pointed out, the problem is not only a problem to Alaska, but also nationwide. Healthcare consumes about 12% of our gross national product. In most cases, that's nearly double what any other of our sister nations nearby are spending on healthcare. It's quite an alarming rate. Approximately 11.6% of U.S. residents' disposable income goes to healthcare, so it's a large portion and growing at a very rapid pace. At the same time, what we're finding is as more money is put into the system, fewer people are actually getting access. The uninsured numbers that you heard a little earlier are our best estimates, but it's also a trend that's happening nationwide. In 1989, it was estimated that there were 38 million Americans without health insurance. In Alaska, with its 90,000, maybe a little ahead of that ratio in the U.S., but still a very concerning part. Just to put this in perspective, the healthcare rise in Alaska itself rises at the daily spending, I'm sorry, is $4.1 million. And the state's portion of that is just a little over $1 million a day. So we, in this state, we spend about $4 million, and we, of that, the state's portion is about $1 million. And it's increasing by $770,000 per day. And nearly $200,000 of that is the state's portion. So it really becomes a very, very scary proposition when you think about just after a few weeks, it starts to double and triple its compounding effect. And on top of that, with the uninsured population, we had 11, it's estimated 11 new residents, or 11 residents get added to the ranks of the uninsured every day. So as every day passes by, we not only spend more money, but fewer people are actually getting access. In the task force, through its expanded role of looking at healthcare delivery and costs throughout the state, it was not operated in a vacuum, as the Senator pointed out. We tried to take testimony from around the state. We did some surveys. We talked to some other states, and we found that it really wasn't one culprit. There were a number of them. Things like certain inefficiencies in the medical delivery system, cost of new medical technology and facilities and medicines in that arena, malpractice insurance and the protective measure costs of malpractice related. In some areas, we have limited competition for providers or insurers. And in some areas, we just don't have providers or insurers in some cases for certain types of risk. There's a limited wellness promotion or prevention and availability to our residents. We have this large population of underinsured and uninsured residents. We see cost shifting, which has gotten to be a big component of the cost shifting between programs, whether it's from the federal level to the state level or from between state programs or even from other employers to the state programs or state or from the state to other employers. Becoming a very, very large issue. Every time we see a budget reduction act at the federal level, let's say in Medicare or Medicaid, that directly gets transposed into the system of the other payor. So that's the same thing is true if you are finding an area to compress price or budgets in healthcare, it many times can be shifted over to another sector. If somebody pays a lower rate in the hospital or doesn't pay that rate, that gets spread among other providers. And the same thing is true with general providers. I mean, there's generally cost-sharing basis for those types of expenditures. We have, as in many other areas, lifestyle-related diseases and injuries. Those are becoming more and more of our medical expenditures. And we have an aging population, so that has contributed. We've added, over the last 5 years, we've added about 13 mandated coverages to the packages. So there's a number of coverages which are mandated. And many of those have some merits, benefits and cost merits on the other side. But those are issues that need to be looked at very closely as we proceed in the area. There's limited access to private health plans. There's a relatively small number of insurers operating in the state, operating for a relatively small group. There is a large population that does not have access to health insurance in the state because it's simply not available. Either they're too small of a group, they're a group that has medical problems, or they're in a restricted industry. Those could be things like fishermen or certain types of other occupations we have, and it's a large population. Very difficult for a small businessman to get health insurance, so that's another area. We have not seen in Alaska, as we have in others, not that they've been the panacea to save money, but managed healthcare systems, HMOs, PPOs that we've seen in other areas, they've had some success, whether or not it's been direct success or cost shifting, but we have not seen that in Alaska for a number of reasons. And last but not least, a lack of end-user involvement and education. The actual consumer is put in a different place. The providers and the insurance companies are linked together. One provides the services, bills the rate, the other pays for it, and the consumer is outside that loop. With all these in mind, the task force searched for a way to bring these points all together and develop a systemic approach to trying to move forward with healthcare delivery and making sure that we have access to quality healthcare for all Alaskans. With that, I'd like to turn it back over to Representative Boyer and Senator Duncan in the sense of House Bill 71 and its companion bill, Senate Bill 83, because this was or is the foundational work out of the task force to look at a way to provide systemic work in trying to reform the problem that we have at hand. Before we get in, if you have any questions specifically about the things that I talked about, I'd be happy to answer them now or at another time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sit here and my eyes almost glaze over when I have to listen to all of this kind of stuff. It's presents a whole set of problems that most of us would feel much more comfortable not having to face, not having to deal with, but unfortunately the dollars and cents will force all of us to deal with these issues. What we're proposing in HB 71 is the creation of a new authority. We're going to call it the Alaska State Health Resources Authority. And on the first page really is where the guts of the bill is and certainly where the controversy begins. And the first section talks about creating and beginning the implementation of a statewide healthcare provider reimbursement system and utilization standards. Short sentence, very few words, huge issue in and of itself. The second major purpose is to provide comprehensive group health insurance for the state, municipalities, school districts, and other employers in the state who elect to participate in that program. Thirdly, we hope to expand the pool of subscribers and to maximize the opportunity for healthcare cost management, i.e., reducing the cost of providing healthcare to Alaskans. And then there are a host of other things that we hope to achieve that are byproducts of that. But those are kind of some of the key things. Although one of the last items that we think we will arrive at is a way to provide some kind of coverage or access for those uninsured or underinsured Alaskans to the healthcare system. We think that generally there are enough dollars available in the healthcare economy of the state of Alaska. It just needs to be shaken and jiggled a little bit here and fine-tuned and adjusted somewhat so that those people who are either uninsured or underinsured and therefore lacking in access to the system can have that access. We think it's a very important thing, and we think as a byproduct we'll see that occur. The I don't want to spend a lot of time on the fine points of the act. I think we create an authority, so there's all the boilerplate language that talks about what an authority of this nature does. It's like, say, it's boilerplate to these types of entities. But Mr. Chairman, perhaps we should just allow the committee members to ask questions and respond in that fashion.
That'd be great. Representative Barnum?
I'm interested in knowing whether we'll have the interim report this next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could respond to that, the task force report I think you're referring to. The task report is presently at the printers, and it should be on the desk of all members by tomorrow. We were required to have it on the 15th, and we're going to make that deadline.
Is there a computer description, a chart description of the costs and jumping, the tripling of costs and how they're related to the same kinds of injuries or the same kinds of illnesses? Is there any graphical description?
I'll let Jeff maybe expand on this, but let me ask just to answer generally your question. We do have a variety of graphs and tables that show the growth of healthcare expenditures in the state of Alaska over the years and where it's projected to go. Also, a breakdown as to how much of that's public sector and private sector, as I recall, and also the uninsured, underinsured population. Not sure that we were able to tie it back to relate it to the type of illness or the type of injury, but perhaps, Jeff.
If I could, Mr. Chair, is that one of the problems we had in the task force was getting that kind of data. We were assimilating data from 12 or 13 different sources and bringing it down to levels that made sense. To answer your question, we were not able to break down that $1.5 billion into certain diagnoses because it's just not available yet. And therefore, in mind, one of the provisions in this bill would require the authority to collect that kind of data and distribute that type of data so we could recognize the trends early and react to them, or act on them rather than react as we do today. So we recognize that it's a problem and try to address that in this authority and give it the power to do that. Right now, there is not a central source to do that.
Person breaks their leg skiing and it costs so many dollars for 3 days in the hospital a year and a half ago, is it triple that cost today? Or, I'm just curious how that would track, and if you had any way of charting that at all.
It's very difficult in the sense that one of the things you find is that if you looked at a line chart of, let's say, just the room and board rates for a hospital, you wouldn't see that. But if you looked at a line chart for some of the ancillary services or some of the specialty services or some of the parts around that, you would see it. So it's not as clear as being able to pinpoint, and that's why we said it's not really one particular group of providers or one, and there are different components that are driving that, things like cost shifting. In 1 year, federal government example made a budget act reduction you saw a bigger impact in that year than you might have the year before. So some of those things at least started becoming more apparent to us. But it is a big component, and it's something that you have to look at piece by piece, because it's not as clear as saying this is how much hospital costs for a doctor.
I apologize, Chairman. I've got to zip off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I'm somewhat concerned about the definition of temporary and emergency and what kind of facility that could be built under that portion of the bill and how long it would last. Would you explain?
Representative Ruff is referring to page 2 of the legislation, which talks about certificate of need and the role of the authority to plan that process. Really, the heart and soul of this bill is not the certificate of need process. We presently do have in statute a certificate of need process that's already operating. There is a companion piece of legislation, I don't know the House number,
69,
but in the Senate, it's Senate Bill 84, it's House Bill 69, that would revise the certificate of need process. And it's based upon legislation that the past administration put forward and did not get through. Basically, what it does is make that process from a overview as far as an oversight function, it strengthens it, and it requires that there be an impact statement or a certificate of need issued, not only for construction, but for renovation, conversion, et cetera, if it's to exceed $1 million. What we do in this legislation is say that that certificate of need process, we believe the construction of facilities, and I'll have to get back to your temporary, construction of building facilities, conversion, expansion, et cetera, plays a major role in how healthcare costs go in the state. And that this authority should review any certificate of need that's submitted and make a recommendation to the department, not that it has veto power. That's how this authority works in conjunction with certificate of need, and that's why that's in this legislation. We've given it review power and recommendation power, but not veto power. Now, to get back to your question, if I can, I was trying to explain why that's in this bill. This is not a certificate of need bill. This is just to say that one of the powers of this authority should be to review certificate of need and make recommendations.
Right. At first blush, though, it appeared that a certificate of need wouldn't have to be issued if it were an emergency situation, and that concerned me.
Jeff, maybe you can answer better, but I don't. I think
the full process wouldn't.
The full process has not happened yet, but there will be.
If I could, the intent of the language on page 2 is this authority. Would issue an impact statement to the certificate of need program when the application for certificate of need. It would not have to issue an impact statement if it was an emergency or temporary certificate, and that's what that language talks about. Certificate of need program has some allowances for temporary or emergency certificates to get a facility through a problematic time, whatever it might be, and it would allow this authority to waive or would waive this authority requirement to issue an impact statement on an emergency or temporary basis. It would not eliminate them having to deal with certificate of need, just this authority's impact.
Okay.
I'm not sure I fully understand a lot of this. Thinking about forgetting the certificate of need, just talking now about this authority itself and what it does, just sort of, if you could draw out how this would be put into effect, let's say over a few years, you know, who is it? Is participation optional by municipalities? Is it mandatory? Just if you give me an idea from the point of view of one municipality or one entity.
Why don't I try to walk you through the process if I can, and Representative Boyer can add in here, correct me as I go. Let me try to walk you through the process. That's really the heart and soul of this piece of legislation, and I think that's a good question. First of all, let me talk about the structure of the authority. The authority will be governed by a board or managed by a board that will be appointed by the governor. And we've got a list of the various entities that need to be represented on that board. It includes the executive branch, labor organizations, school districts, municipalities, private sector employers, and healthcare providers. The authority will be operated or managed by that board of directors of 9 people, I think is the level we have now. And they will, of course, hire staff, et cetera, to do their work. They have some major responsibilities outlined in this legislation, and that's really what your question came to. And so let me kind of walk through that step by step. We've broken the operation of the authority into 2 phases, because we believe to address this whole issue comprehensively and do it well, we need to set out some standards, some guidelines, and some deadlines for when things will be done. The first phase,
will be that the authority, their staff, consultants, will work with providers, negotiate with providers, statewide provider reimbursement schedules and utilization standards. And when we say statewide, what we mean is that there will be those schedules statewide, but there may be more than one schedule. For example, they have to take into consideration actual provider costs when they're doing these reimbursement schedules. And that may change depending on where you're at, depending on whether you're in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau or elsewhere, because there's different competition levels, there's different transportation costs, there's just different costs of doing business. So they have to consider the actual provider cost, and we're going to try to be more definitive on what those components of provider cost should be as the legislation proceeds forward. And they set up at the same time the statewide system of utilization standards. The question then is, who uses that? Well, in the legislation, we have mandated that all public employers will use those statewide reimbursement schedules, provider reimbursement schedules, and utilization standards. The figure that we have as to how many people that would be is 135,000 employees and their dependents. And when you take all the public employees in the state, university, municipalities, school districts, and other public entities, you take their employees and their dependents, that comes out to 135,000 consumers, individuals. Those individuals would use provider reimbursement schedules. For example, if it's determined that an arm operation of some kind was to cost $500 in Anchorage, that's what they would be charged. The insurance company would pay their 90 or 80%. The employee would pay the balance, the other 20%. The providers on those schedules, or those schedules once they're established, the provider would not be allowed to charge more and balance bill back against the employee. That's just cost shifting, and that's what we're trying to get at. So in that phase, it's mandatory for all public employers. It's also optional for the private sector. Private sector employers, large corporate employers, could opt in to use those schedules and say, okay, that's what we're going to pay for our services also. In our meetings with private sector employers, as we discussed this, as I said, they indicated they've had a major problem with health care costs also. It seems to me that there's substantial interest in looking at what we're doing and following that process. So we're trying to include as many people as possible into that payor system, and bring as many people in, public employers and private employers. And that, again, repeats, mandatory for all public employers, voluntary for private sector employees. We've got to keep in mind that this is not plan design. It's not changing any municipality or school districts or collective bargaining unit plan. They can have the same type of plan that they've always had, with the same benefits covered or the same services covered. It could be 90-10, 80-20. It could be a $100 deductible, $500 deductible. This does not impact that. They can have Aetna, they can have Blue Cross, they can be self-insured, whatever they're presently doing. All this says is that no matter who you have or what your plan is, you'll pay X dollars for that service. Phase two is the area where we believe, after we've controlled the cost, the inflationary rise we estimate in the state is somewhere close to 20%, or has been averaging about 20% a year. And by setting these reimbursement schedules and utilization standards is the goal, to slow that inflationary rise, and this is a target to slow it from 20% consumer price index to 5 or 6%. I don't think anyone believes, just to be quite upfront, anyone believes that we can go in and tell a doctor, you got to charge 20% less than what you know, for everything you've previously been charged. The first thing we need to recognize is we need quality care in this state, we need the providers. You can't operate without them. But the goal is, by bringing some standardization, identifying the components of price increases, we can slow that inflationary rise. Let me just tell you right up front, this is the most controversial part of the bill, you probably understand. I mean, it's kind of like an APUC for doctors, right? We have an APUC that looks at utilities, electric utilities. It's kind of like the same thing for, not doctors, excuse me. I've always got to correct myself. The hospital things get upset when I leave them out. It's APUC for providers, okay? The second phase then is where we would then give the ability to the authority to procure, primarily procure, or provide insurance for groups of folks who might like to pool together for that purpose. I'll give you a couple of examples of how I see this working. All school districts may decide it would be to their advantage to come together into a pool and to go to the authority and say, we would like you to procure an insurance policy for all school districts. It's a much bigger group of people, it gives them better bargaining power, and they may be able to get a better rate as a result of that.
Or municipalities might decide that, or collective bargaining organizations might decide they want to pull together. Secondly, and where I think the real benefit comes in being in addressing the uninsured, underinsured problem is that I can envision, or we envision, this authority looking around the state and seeing who doesn't have insurance. Where is it not accessible? A small businessman may be getting insurance now, but he's paying, it's a $5,000 deductible policy, he's not getting preventive care. Fishermen may not be able to get any policy at all because of what Mr. Malik mentioned as being a high-risk occupation. We've also released information I've been able to read indicates that small businessmen who have 15 or less employees just don't have access, in many cases, to health insurance. So the authority could look around the state, identify that pool of people who don't have insurance, pool together all small businessmen, say, well, look, if you all come together, we'll go out and procure a policy from you, for you, with that great number from the insurance industry. The MIHO insurance industry at that point would become competitive and say, there's an opportunity for us that didn't exist before. We can provide insurance to that large number of small business people at a reasonable rate and get them into the preventive care market. Or they may decide, for example, if it's an area where there's not insurance available, they may pull people together, put together a very basic policy and say, we'll provide this policy to you. In that area, they may come into the actual providing of insurance. So. And that's all voluntary. We're not mandating that anyone pool. It's all voluntary at that point. So it's a comprehensive approach. And we started at the top end because, quite honestly, the state right now could address the uninsured, underinsured problem easily if we had the money. All you'd need to do is put $60 million in your budget and be sure everybody had adequate health care and access to it. The problem is, as those inflationary costs go up, as medical care costs go up, $60 million becomes $120 million. So on, we can't afford it. So our goal is to control the cost at the top end, narrow the population of the uninsured, underinsured by giving the authority the power to pool people together to procure insurance. And once you've narrowed that population, undoubtedly you're going to end up with some segment of the population where they can't afford insurance at any cost, and we'll have to use state money to provide health care for them, but it's a shrinking population, and it's with controlled cost. That's a long answer to a short question.
That was very helpful.
And I hope that it made some type of sense. So,
and you need to can that. That's about as tight a package description of what we're about here as you could get.
And let me add a couple other things.
I had it all
tied up, but let me say that, you know, there is concern, and I just want to reemphasize it. There is concern among the provider community, and I understand that and I appreciate that. We want to work with that community and have been working with that community to try to define what the components of any reimbursement schedule should be, what this authority should be considering and looking at as they design reimbursement schedules and utilization standards. We all know malpractice insurance is increasing. We all know other things are happening. That's got to be taken into consideration, right? And we need to figure some way long-term to address that if we can. Secondly, we know that the insurance industry is concerned about this authority becoming a provider of insurance. I think that's only secondary as far as this authority goes. I think what is the most important is that they be able to pull people together to go out and procure insurance. And quite honestly, I have a lot of faith in the insurance industry. I think they'll get competitive and they'll see the opportunity in the market to begin providing insurance for people where they couldn't before. And so, you know, the long-term goal is that this authority gets into very little actual provision for being the insurer itself, but mostly into procuring. We've got some amendments, or we'll be proposing some amendments that will ensure that if we do get into providing insurance, if this authority writes its own policies, that it's there's protection for the general fund, protection that the policies are doable, that we're not getting ourselves into some big loss down line. We're aware that we're working provision insurance on that. Putting that package together, and we'll be forwarding some amendments.
Where's the provision where they've got the authority to write their own policies?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the provision really shows on page 3. Wait a minute. Yes, actually, on page 3, if you look at subsection D.
think subsection D is, well, on, actually on line 16, where it says, has elected to participate in group health insurance obtained by the authority and may provide group health insurance to employees of other groups. So when you say and may provide, that gives them the authority to put together their own basic plan if they need to do that. And, you know, sometimes when we talk about this, in fact, I would refer you back to page one of the bill, line 8, there's a word missing. It should be procure or provide. Sometimes when we get talking about this, we so often say provide and think that's solving the problem, but I think we've got to differentiate between the two. Procure is going out to the insurance industry and procuring a policy. Providing, in my mind, means that this authority might actually put together a basic policy and say, we're offering it to you. So it's strung throughout the legislation, Mr. Chairman, where, and actually, on page 5 is even more clear, I guess. I just hadn't been asked that question before, so I'm kind of wandering through the bill. Page 5 talks about procurement of insurance.
I guess my confusion maybe is a lack of understanding of this whole process. The for most of what your description and for most of my reading of it, I get the impression of just pooling people. Now, is that, that's a separate concept right here from what you're talking about. Pooling people, trying to get people together and putting them together with carriers, separate carriers. In this procurement of insurance section on page 5, it still seems to be talking about obtaining policies, not providing policies. What's the missing sign? Oh, no, I know. I actually use the word self-insure in section B there. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. It talks about both, I think.
Yeah.
We'll be sure that's clear. But
yeah, I guess that was my problem reading, is that what part wasn't clear. I had another question, but are there any other questions from other committee members? The I understand the concerns from the providers. What concerns have you heard to date from municipalities on this? Some were mentioned to me yesterday just in a general sense, but not anything specific about the bill, just the concerns with it.
Well, I'd be interested in knowing which ones were mentioned to you in a general sense, but we have met with municipalities. In fact, had the opportunity during the last Municipal League Convention in Anchorage to be on two or three panels where this was discussed. I think three of us were on one panel, and I made a presentation to a couple of other groups, including municipal finance officers, about it. Also had the opportunity just two or three days ago to meet with the Municipal Legislative Committee about it. I have not heard any specific concerns from them. What I have heard is probably what everyone has as they look at this legislation, initially a lot of confusion about two things. One is, how is that going to impact them and their collective bargaining agreements that they might have with labor unions within their municipality? And that's a legitimate concern. And we've addressed that in this legislation by doing two things. One is, we, first of all, in the first phase where we're rate setting, et cetera, rate setting, doing utilization standards, we don't interfere at all with plan design, who the carrier is, what their benefits are, what their copayment is, what their deductible is, and all. There's no interference at all. It's just that they would use those schedules for the purpose of paying for services, and that's what the insurance company would pay on. In the second phase, when it comes to pooling, there could be a concern there. For example, if the municipality of Anchorage, as an example, or Fairbanks or Juneau, if the administration of that municipality could just say, we're going to elect into a pool, that could violate collective bargaining agreements. However, if you'll note in the bill, we have defined employer for that protection. We have defined employer as a number of means: a state, municipality, a district, a collective bargaining unit, et cetera. So, for example, the municipality of Anchorage can't opt all their employees in to a pool. The state of Alaska can't say, we're going to join a pool, because we've got different collective bargaining units out there. The collective bargaining unit has to say, we would like to be in a pool, because they have different ways of handling their health care problems. The other concern that I guess I've heard expressed is, I think, and we heard the other day, was just a confusion about how is this going to impact benefits, right? The simple answer to that is, it doesn't change benefits, it just changes what you pay. So the long-term impact, once we, I think, get the confusion in the legislation straightened out, the long-term impact is going to be positive for municipalities. Right now, municipalities, in 1990, the health care cost for all municipalities in the state is $40 million. That's what they're spending on health care expenditures. By the year 2000, it'll be $300 million if something doesn't happen. And that's a tremendous
amount of money, and it impacts their budget just like it impacts everyone else's budget. So I think in the long term, it can only be beneficial. I'm not suggesting that they've, you know, endorsed or done anything. They're aware of what the legislation can do.
Yeah, just another couple of points. You know, the efforts we've made just on what I call, it's almost the laughable kinds of things we did that others had implemented in other states years and years ago, resulted in a reduction in our premium, for instance. We were looking at $435 to $485 a month. There were different groups that had different bargaining units within the state that were paying as much as $485 or facing a $485 a month per employee benefit premium. Those effectively, because they have something like a Me Too provision in the various contracts, once you get one in, the rest of them bump into the same category, have gotten that down to $385 a month. At $385 a month, and it was just renegotiated, so we've got another year at the same price. We'll have had that $385 premium for a 2-year period, longer than any other state has had, you know, relative stability in that premium rate. I mean, we brought a lot to bear into that process, and what the other municipalities and school districts and the university system are finding, although the university I think is still under us, we're not the most expensive group out there anymore. We're under 50%. I mean, 60% of the folks out there that are buying, you know, major buyers, municipalities and school districts stuff, are paying more for their employees' coverage than we are. And we used to characterize this plan as the Cadillac plan and the most expensive plan. Well, it's still a pretty good Cadillac. It's a little older now, but it's not the most expensive plan. And I think once the process works here, I mean, you become to be a bigger and bigger gorilla all the time. Your buying power, you're able to wield something different in the marketplace than you are today. And I think that the advantages will be obvious to school districts and municipalities. And you'll find people opting in, wanting to be in next to the gorilla.
Let me just add one other point, and again, I'm not speaking of municipalities, but at the legislative committee, last municipal committee, the chairman of that committee is someone you probably know very well. But she indicated, for example, that the Fairbanks and Norwalk Borough, their health care premiums had gone from $285 in 1990 to over $500 and some. It's doubled in the last 2 years, their health care premiums. That's the problem municipalities face. And that's the problem we're trying to get to. I mean, if that healthcare premium doubles like that, that means something else is going wanting, right? Some other service is not being provided, or Representative Boyer's tax assessments are going up on top of the police pay. So that's the problem we're trying to address.
Mr. Bruce Cummings is here too from administration. You're welcome to stay while he comes up as well. So, Bruce?
Representatives of labor organizations on health cost containment task force, they also participated in recommendations of this legislation. We believe that it has a lot of potential. While we'll never see our health costs going down, that's probably out of the question. We can do some things to slow the increase in costs on this.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Any questions? We'll hold another hearing on this to give everyone a chance to testify who wants to. If there's anyone here today who needs to testify today because they're in town or something and won't be able to testify by other means, other times, you're welcome to do so. If anyone wishes to do so. Representative Taylor?
Okay,
Representative
Taylor. Yeah, I have been intimately involved in the legislation first created Coolin. My bill. And, I think I've probably as a safe and theme for Star Trek, going where no man has gone before. But I applaud your efforts in attempting to do this, and I want to work closely with the other. I think it looks like it's got some possibilities.
Thank you. I feel the same way, too. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your coming before today, and yeah, appreciate your help with this. And we'll schedule a hearing soon.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn the hearing today.